I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this month, House Republicans released their new tax plan, and last week, Senate Republicans introduced theirs. While there are differences between the two proposals, the GOP leadership promises that the final bill will ease the tax burden on the middle class. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan touting the Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
The Tax Cut and Jobs Act will deliver real relief for people in the middle, people who are also striving to get there. With this plan, the typical family of four will save $1,182 a year on their taxes. For many families, having an additional $1,182 more will make a real difference. That $1,182 more covers about a year's worth of gas for your car. It covers your family's phone bill for the year, depending on how much data, of course, your kids use.
We asked Damian Paletta to walk us through the numbers to see who would end up winners and losers if some version of these plans becomes the law. President Trump says he wants a finished bill on his desk by Christmas. Paletta is senior economics correspondent for The Washington Post. And Damian Paletta, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with the middle class. Is this a middle class tax cut? And I realize we're talking about two different plans, but nonetheless, what do you see?
That's right. I mean, I have to say the claims are pretty misleading. I mean, on net, yes, a middle class family would get a tax cut. But there's so many different definitions of middle class in this country, obviously. You know, a middle class family in California is much different than a middle class family in Mississippi. And so, you know, there will be cutting tax rates across the board. They will be doubling the standard deduction, and they will be expanding the child tax credit. But they're also going to be making changes that could push up taxes on middle-class families. For example, you know, if you live in a state with high state taxes, high property taxes, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, California, you could see your taxes go up because you will no longer be able to deduct those taxes you pay to your state or to your municipality. So, you know, this is going to have a different impact for a lot of people. Some people could see a real benefit, but some people could see their taxes go up in the middle class.
Who would you say are the biggest winners? And I realize the president hasn't signed this yet, but as you look at these two proposals.
Right. And so obviously they're kind of marketing this as a middle class focused tax bill. But really the biggest winners are large corporations that would see their tax rates go down from 35% to 20%. Businesses that are structured in a way that they pay through the individual income tax code. These can be smaller companies, but they can also be large law firms, for example. They're known as pass-throughs, but they are structured in such a way that they don't pay the corporate income tax, so their taxes would go down as well. And also, you know, the wealthy would see a big tax benefit, obviously, by getting rid of the estate tax in the House bill or really scaling back the estate tax in the Senate bill, and also the elimination of the alternative minimum tax. Those are things that could really help the wealthy. So, you know, we see a lot of benefits there. I think we're trying to still get to the bottom of what the impact on the middle class would be. But obviously, a lot of people think the wealthy and corporations would really come out well with these proposals.
My understanding is that the estate tax applies to something like 5,000, obviously very wealthy families. And one of the arguments to get rid of the estate tax was that it is a double taxation, essentially paying a second tax on the estate tax as it is structured today. But if you look at this GOP plan where they basically say that you will not get a deduction for state and local taxes, isn't that double taxation?
Sure. And I think it can be kind of misleading because, yes, some of the money would be taxed, is taxed twice, you know, when an estate tax kicks in, which is, you know, if it's an estate over $5.5 million for an individual or if a, you know, a married couple dies at the same time, it's an $11 million estate. So, but there should also be situations where they made investments in those estates that they never paid taxes on. So if the investments were kind of held in perpetuity, they were never taxed. So I think both sides kind of give misleading characterizations of what the estate tax does and doesn't do. It doesn't look like the estate tax will be repealed just based on the way some Senate Republicans feel about it. Susan Collins of Maine and Mike Rounds of North Dakota has said, you know, we shouldn't get rid of the estate tax. It's just going to benefit the wealthy too much. So they're probably going to scale back the estate tax, but it looks unlikely that it'll be completely repealed.
What's going to happen this week? And will there be, do you think, some kind of bill that Republicans all agree on by Friday, for instance?
Great question. This is a really pivotal week for the, you know, Republican tax cut effort. The House of Representatives is expected to pass their version of the tax cut bill by Thursday or Friday. You know, shouldn't be that hard. They have a big majority there, but it's a huge step because, you know, the White House is really looking for some big legislative victories to go into 2018. And by getting the House to approve this, given, you know, how there's been some hand-wringing over specifics, it would be a big step. And the Senate Finance Committee, which is the tax writing committee in the Senate, they're planning to hold a vote on their version of the bill this week, starting today on Monday. And the bill only came out on Thursday, so we're still kind of pouring through the details. And there's going to be some changes made, too, which could obviously have, you know, big implications. But they're hoping to pass their bill by the end of the week through the Senate Finance Committee and then possibly try to pass it through the Senate the week after Thanksgiving. And obviously, you know, a bill can't become a law until we have matching House and Senate versions.
Right.
So they'll have to reconcile the differences, which, you know, are not insignificant. But if they can get that far in just a couple weeks, you know, they have a good chance of getting this thing passed into law.
And how many pages of bill are we talking about, or bills, should I say?
I think it's over 400. The House bill is over 400 pages. Remember, it makes changes to the taxes that virtually every American pays, and it's kind of broken into sections that would affect the taxes that individuals and families pay, a section that for taxes that corporations pay, and a section about kind of the international treatment of taxes, multinational companies or companies that you know, are based overseas but, you know, have business dealings in the United States. So it's pretty complicated stuff. And, you know, I think we've already seen a couple hundred pages of amendments filed to the Senate bill. So, you know, these things could grow even more potentially, you know, based on how things shake out this week.
Do the Democrats have any role to play in these negotiations?
You know, it doesn't seem like it. They do continue to meet with the White House. There was a meeting last week with senior White House officials and about seven Senate Democrats. Obviously, the White House's math would get a lot easier if a couple Democrats would say they would support the plan. And right now, because right now they only have a 52-48 majority, the Republicans in the Senate. And you have this, obviously, you know, this race in Alabama that's going to happen in December for a Senate seat. And if that doesn't go the Republicans' way, then it could have big implications, because I think the you know, the next senator would be sworn in early January. Maybe they wouldn't have it wrapped up by then. So they have a real thin margin of error, and if a couple Senate Republicans are uncomfortable with any specific provision, then you know, this thing kind of goes down in the Senate like a lot of bills do. So they would love to have some support from Democrats, but right now we haven't seen them make any changes to the bill in a way that would try to lure Democrats, you know, into their camp.
Let me read a couple of comments. An email from Milton who says, when the tax cuts end up driving up the deficit by the advertised $1.5 trillion, the Republicans will call for cuts to programs because we can't afford them. These will be cuts to programs for working class and middle class Americans. And picking up on that, they do have to, I guess, abide by this threshold of $1.5 trillion. They can't add to the debt. Do I have that right, Damian?
That's exactly right, and you're kind of on the big issue. There's a Senate rule called the Byrd Rule that stipulates that the, you know, a tax plan that's passed through reconciliation, which, you know, is sort of a technicality, but it's really important, that they want to pass this tax cut with only 50 or 51 votes, right? Not the 60 that you usually need in the Senate. And to do that, you cannot pass a tax cut that adds to the deficit after 10 years. So they sort of bought themselves this $1.5 trillion cushion for the first 10 years, which is, you know, it's a lot of money to add to the debt. But they have to design it in a way that it cannot add to the debt in the second, you know, in year 11. And right now their bill, they acknowledged last week, does not meet that requirement. Their bill would add to the deficit in year 11. So they, because when you lock in, you know, corporate tax rates at 20% down from 35%, of course you're going to get less tax revenue than you would if you had higher taxes. And so they have to fix that, and it looks like we're going to find out kind of their plan in the next few days in the Senate on how they plan to fix it. Now, the choices they have to make are not easy ones. They can either propose having the whole thing sunset after 10 years, so the tax rates snap back up, kind of like what we saw with the Bush tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, or they could put some kind of legislative time bomb in the bill that would have a big tax increase of another variety in the year 2027, I think under the assumption that, you know, a later Congress would go in and just, you know, remove it. That, you know, that's kind of a legislative gimmick that I think some Republicans might not go for, but those are kind of the tough choices that they have to make in the next few days if they want to get this thing to pass, you know, Senate rules.
Let me read another email, this one from Dave. Does anyone really think the 500 largest American corporations will bring that money into the U.S. and pay the money that they owe in taxes? He's saying $620 billion in taxes. Of course, that requires, Damon, you looking into your crystal ball. And it does, these plans do call for reducing the corporate tax rate. But do these corporations pay 35% today?
No, they don't. And some pay nowhere close. Some pay almost no taxes. But some pay quite a bit of taxes. And I think, you know, the questioner has a really good point. There are several trillion dollars that U.S. companies have stored overseas from, you know, overseas earnings. Now, whether they've, you know, twisted themselves into a pretzel to try to avoid paying U.S. taxes and have, you know, operations in the Bahamas or Ireland that are, you know, kind of brass plates only, you know, I think that differs from company to company. But, you know, the president has said that there's several trillion dollars sitting offshore that this bill would try to lure back to the U.S. And his idea is that if this money comes back into the U.S., it'll just by its sheer force help spur economic growth. You know, it'll help raise wages. Companies will reinvest that money in the U.S. It'll, you know, drive up the stock market and do a host of other things. And, you know, it's possible that's true. I think, you know, if we look at what has happened in the past, there was a similar experience during the Bush administration where they had something called a tax holiday, essentially let companies bring money back at a low tax rate in a small window. And I think, you know, both sides, Democrats and Republicans, acknowledge that that money was not reinvested back into the economy. It was used to push up, you know, executive compensation. It was used to, you know, for companies to buy back dividends or to give dividends and buy back stock. And it was also used by companies that ended up laying off workers. So, you know, it's not necessarily a given that if that money comes back, it's going to lead to a big jolt or a shot in the arm to the economy.
Damien, almost out of time here. No time to really answer this. But are we talking then about trickle down? Is this the thinking behind these Republican plans?
It sounds an awful lot like it.
It does.
Think they feel like they have economic theory to prove that it won't happen, but I think people are going to have to make a, you know, big gamble that that's going to be what happens.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today, Radio Time, shoehorning a lot of information into 12 and a half minutes. Damien Poletta, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's senior economics correspondent for The Washington Post. And he made mention of bringing some of those corporate profits back to shore. We're going to be talking about what is known now as the Paradise Papers. We'll be talking about that with Jesse Drucker from The New York Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last year, we learned about the Panama Papers, millions of leaked documents that revealed how a Panamanian law firm helped its wealthy and connected clients use offshore havens to shield their money. This month, we're learning about the Paradise Papers, millions of leaked documents from a Bermuda law firm, Appleby, that has helped their clients to hide their assets and avoid taxes by setting up offshore accounts in tax havens. And among their clients, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Bono, Queen Elizabeth, Apple, Nike, it's a long list of who's who. In both leaks, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists brought together reporters from around the world to examine and write about the documents. One of those reporters joins us, Jesse Drucker, reporter for The New York Times, and he joins us from the studios of The New York Times. And Jesse Drucker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do we know about this firm, Appleby? My understanding, it's been around for something like 100 years. What should we know about Appleby?
Well, so Appleby is a lot like is like many offshore law firms. They are headquartered in Bermuda, but have since expanded and have offices in almost all of the important offshore jurisdictions, whether it's Jersey, Guernsey, the British Virgin Islands, Grand Cayman. And they are kind of a full-service provider for all the various functions that people and companies turn to the offshore world for, whether it's setting up subsidiaries, essentially shell companies, to help them avoid taxes, which is what Apple did, whether it's offshore entities that are used to make big investments and potentially help hide people's identities, which is what happened in the case of billionaire Yuri Milner, whose company used offshore entities set up by Appleby in the Isle of Man to make investments in companies like Twitter. I mean, in general, these jurisdictions are used for everything from tax avoidance to tax evasion to setting up structures to help frustrate your creditors, to keep your identities hidden from authorities or sometimes even from the companies you're investing in. And Appleby did a piece of all of that.
Well, part of this full service is secrecy, part of what they offer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is sort of the kind of name of the game in those jurisdictions. I mean, to some degree, I mean, hopefully we'll get into this at some point in the conversation. To some degree, that's true here in the U.S. as well. And there are lots of big U.S. law firms that make use of the secrecy advantages that exist right here in the U.S. to do those sorts of structures as well. But absolutely, I mean, that is an enormous part of the appeal of those jurisdictions, that they help people remain anonymous, whether it's from tax collectors or their creditors or from their business partners or from the companies that they're investing in. Anonymity has a big advantage if you're trying to do any of those things.
Is it legal? And I ask that because Tim Cook, who's, of course, the head of Apple, saying basically we are paying all the taxes that we are required to pay. So are these this company and these offshore entities, are they legal?
Sure, they can be. okay. You know, the existence of an offshore entity, you know, having an offshore bank account, having a company set up in the Isle of Man, that in and of itself, there's nothing illegal about that. But the anonymity afforded by those jurisdictions and, in some cases, the tax benefits enable you to do things that may either be illegal or may really be pushing the envelope.
Let's talk a little bit about Apple, something that you wrote about. They, of course, here's where it gets confusing, because their headquarters is in Cupertino, California. But nonetheless, they said first that they are basically an Irish-based company, and now they're at the Isle of Jersey. What happened in Ireland that moved them to Jersey?
Well, So let's go back a number of years.
Sure.
I mean, Apple for a number of years has had, and I think I want to talk about something that I think there's an important distinction to be made here that's important for thinking about some of the things in the GOP tax plans. You know, Apple, like a number of big U.S. pharma companies and tech companies, has had significant operations in Ireland for a number of years. They have about 6,000 employees there. But, and Ireland, you know, many years ago introduced a low 12.5% corporate tax rate as a way to try to lure jobs to the country there. And to some degree, that has been successful. The other key parts of that equation, obviously, are that Ireland had for many years the appeal of low wages, that has largely gone away. But you basically had an educated workforce that spoke English that was going to get paid a lot less than what the equivalent people would get paid here in the U.S., and then also had this benefit of low corporate income taxes. What has happened is that in addition to the low corporate income tax, the other benefit is that Ireland has made it very easy for companies essentially to use Ireland as kind of a gateway into the offshore world. In other words, we talk about jobs in Ireland and the low taxes in Ireland, but one of the big appeals of Ireland is that it enables you to push profits on paper through Ireland and into places like Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, Jersey, Guernsey, etc. And what we saw with Apple for a number of years was that they had Irish subsidiaries that declared their tax residency nowhere in the world, right? So they were basically paying almost no income taxes. And Apple was moving tens of billions of dollars in profits into this structure. And in 2013, the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations did a lengthy report and a hearing where they basically called them out on this. And Tim Cook, as you said, very indignantly at this hearing about 4.5 years ago, said, "We don't rely on tax gimmicks and we don't put our profits into some Caribbean island." And what happened was that in part because of this hearing and because of some other things that were going on, hearings in the UK involving Google and Amazon and Starbucks, there was a lot of pressure on Ireland to roll back some of these advantages that they were offering to multinationals. And so they started to do that. And they said, look, we're going to get rid of this no tax residency benefit here. If you're an Irish company, you've got to be resident somewhere in the world. And so Apple, seeing this, said, look, we better come up with some alternative because they're going to make our current tax avoidance structure impossible. And so Apple's advisors at Baker McKenzie, which is one of the biggest law firms in the world, they're headquartered in Chicago but have, you know, a huge presence all over the country and all over the world, basically put into motion a plan to come up with an alternative. And folks in their San Francisco office reach out to Applebee's lawyers around the offshore world and basically said to each one of them, look, make a case for why we should use your office and your jurisdiction as a place to hide Apple's profits, whether you're Bermuda or the British Virgin Islands or Jersey. And this process went on for a little while, and Apple and Baker McKenzie basically eventually settled on Jersey. And so they went from a structure that had Irish subsidiaries that were resident nowhere in the world for tax purposes to Irish subsidiaries that are instead resident in Jersey, which is a tax haven and for the most part has no corporate income tax. And so they've essentially replaced a structure where they had hundreds of billions of dollars in one thing that Ireland and the world didn't like. And now they have a different structure that basically provides the same level of tax benefits.
Well, and you mentioned the fact, and we were talking earlier in the hour about what the Republicans are proposing in order to reduce the corporate tax rate. If they reduce the tax rate to something like 20%, would a company like Apple have any reason to move their business, so to speak, to the United States?
Well, so let's say a couple things about that. First of all, let's take the second part of that. When we talk about moving business and moving jobs, remember that the companies are not moving jobs to these places, right? Apple has no jobs in Jersey or the British Virgin Islands. You know, same, you know, Google is piling up unbelievable amounts of profits in Bermuda. There are no jobs in Bermuda for Google. They're moving profits. And the reason that's important is that the discussion around this stuff often gets framed as if you cut taxes and the jobs will come back to the U.S., but the jobs aren't in Bermuda and the Cayman Islands, et cetera. So there aren't jobs to bring back to the U.S. from those places. What you're trying to do is have the profits allocated where they actually belong. As far as cutting the rate to 20%, I mean, you have to remember with U.S. companies, they're not moving their profits out of the U.S. into European countries where the rate is around 20%. And they're not even moving them to Ireland where it's 12.5%. They are moving them through all of those countries into zero tax jurisdictions. So it's very difficult to understand the theory that cutting it from 35 to 20 would bring those profits back here. Now, there may be other reasons to cut it to 20%, but that wouldn't really seem to be one of them. Now, there are other provisions in the GOP tax plan that would probably encourage some of the kind of activity that Google, Apple, et cetera, have been engaging in for years. We can talk about those if you want, but I mean, the argument that going from 35 to 20% would change some of this behavior isn't really kind of borne out by what we see in terms of the real world.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jesse Drucker. He's a reporter for the New York Times and one of several hundred reporters who are looking at the Paradise Papers. These are leaked documents from this Bermuda law firm we've been talking about how their clients can hide their assets and avoid taxes. And the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists brought together lots of reporters from around the world, including Jesse Drucker, to take a look at some of these documents from this Bermuda law firm. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me pick there's so much to talk about, but let me pick up on what is a tax haven. And you talked about the Isle of Man and Jersey and Bermuda. There are others as well, Cayman Islands. Are there tax havens in the United States? You wrote a story not so long ago about Reno, Nevada.
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, the United States of America has many of the attributes of a tax haven, and those have become more pronounced in the last couple of years. I mean, the story there, very briefly, is that about a decade ago, a former banker at UBS, the Swiss bank, basically blew the whistle on UBS's role helping wealthy Americans and wealthy people around the world evade taxes by setting up undeclared offshore bank accounts using the Swiss bank. And a number of other Swiss banks were doing very similar activity, and dozens of them eventually entered into a program with the United States where they paid fines, they paid penalties. You know, dozens of Swiss bankers were indicted. And the fallout of this is that a number of countries around the world, basically pretty much every civilized Western country, agreed to enter into information sharing agreements to try to prevent other countries from using their jurisdictions to help people, to help the other citizens evade taxes. And the United States is the one major country that has not signed on to these Wow. regulations or to these guidelines. And so the result is that there are now bankers both here in the U.S. and abroad who are actively marketing the U.S.'s failure to sign on to these protocols as an attraction to bring their accounts out of places like the Bahamas and BVI and Switzerland and into the United States. And, you know, the article I wrote last year was about Rothschild, the big European bank, and how they recently opened up an outfit in Reno, Nevada, for that very purpose. So, I mean, the U.S. has for years had issues with secrecy around beneficial owners of companies and around not sharing information with tax authorities in other countries to help citizens of other countries evade taxes. So, you know, it's very sort of difficult to kind of define what exactly a tax haven is. I mean, places like Bermuda are easy because there's essentially no income tax, but, you know, the U.S. in many ways has many of the attributes of a tax haven for citizens of other countries. In other words, citizens of other countries have the ability to use the U.S. to help avoid or evade taxes in their home countries.
Do we know how much money is being held in these offshore accounts? I realize an offshore account can be in the middle of the desert, but nonetheless, do we know how much money is not being paid, or how much taxes is not being paid?
Well, so that's sort of a tricky question. I mean, we can answer this sort of two different ways. There's sort of two different ways to think about that. I mean, on the U.S. side, the types of sort of aggressive profit shifting that goes on with the likes of Apple and Google and Cisco, that is the latest estimate from the OECD is that is costing tax authorities around the world something in the order of $250 billion. Here in the U.S., I've seen estimates range from $70 to $100 billion per year as to how much the U.S. is losing because of big multinational companies pushing their profits offshore. There are various estimates for how much is sitting in offshore tax havens that is that is not being declared, and that is. There's an economist at the University of California at Berkeley named Gabriel Zuckman who wrote a piece just the other day, and his latest estimate is close to $9 trillion held offshore. Yeah, $9 trillion being held offshore in these tax havens. Now, not all of that. I think his assumption is that most of that is not being declared to tax authorities. But you know, it's much harder to know with that because a lot of those accounts not being declared, that's illegal and sort of tracing the magnitude of that. But, I mean, I think it's safe to say that it is in the trillions of dollars. There are other estimates that put it at more than twice that, at more than twice the $9 trillion. But it's something, I mean, I think there's a view that it's a problem in that range.
Is it, can we say then these offshore accounts make the poor people poorer and rich people richer?
Well, I don't know about the first part. I mean, they definitely make the wealthy wealthier, right? Because I mean, to the degree that you have income that you're not declaring it to to tax authorities, that obviously increases your wealth. And, you know, the same goes for the kind of legal or potentially legal versions of aggressive profit shifting that the companies engage in, which is obviously that has the effect of increasing the you know, the pre-tax wealth of the people who are the shareholders in those companies, both sort of broadly the shareholder class, but then also the executives in those companies. But yeah, clearly, I think, you know, tax avoidance and tax evasion has a fairly underappreciated role in exacerbating income inequality.
In fact, I just scribbled down the words income inequality. That really just drives this. You've been looking at a number of these documents. We have a break in about a minute or so, and I want to talk a little bit more about Yuri Milner. And has the president in any way, have we heard anything from the White House about the Paradise Papers?
Not to my knowledge, actually.
Mm-hmm. How about from Congress? I mean, is a big splash when some of these reports came out in the last couple of weeks. Have we heard anything from members of Congress about the Paradise Papers?
I think Bernie Sanders had something to say about the need to hold hearings, and I feel like there are some other members of Congress who have said things specifically. You know, my colleague Mike McIntyre wrote an article last week about how there were disclosures in the documents that show that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, has a stake in a company that is doing significant business with Vladimir Putin's son-in-law, as well as some other very significant Russian oligarchs. But, you know, I think that's kind of been the extent of it here in the U.S.
That is Jesse Drucker, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a reporter for The New York Times. In fact, one of many reporters who are doing some work with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists looking at the Paradise Papers. And we are walking through what some of these papers reveal about the wealthy, the well-connected, whether they are individuals or corporations. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY. In Philadelphia, we're talking about the Paradise Papers. These are millions of leaked documents that reveal the ways that wealthy and powerful and the powerful hide their money in offshore tax havens. And again, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists has pored through these documents. They found how celebrities and politicians and business leaders like Wilbur Ross and Bono, Queen Elizabeth, corporations like Apple and Nike are using these offshore vehicles to evade paying taxes. Let me get Gar from Cherry Hill, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Gar. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Fascinating discussion.
Thanks.
This is not a new problem. This issue was addressed in the 70s by a gentleman named Wilbur Mills, who was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's one of the last chairmen that actually wrote tax law. And it's addressed in the original code, IRS sections 951 to 960, which has to do with subpart F income, which is, let me get my breath.
Well, you know,
it's foreign source earnings of U.S. corporations are to be taxed in the United States in the year in which they are earned, subject to a foreign tax credit, and that tax credit cannot exceed the tax liability had those earnings been earned in the United States, and subject to rules of transfer pricing so that profits could not be moved from one jurisdiction to another the way Apple has done, where Apple generates half of its worldwide earnings in the United States, but the sales, the revenue, the cost of goods to Apple in the U.S. is a fraction of the real cost.
Well, you know what, Gar? Let me take your point, and what you're saying is this is illegal, and we can go back to the 70s and Wilbur Mills. Jesse Drucker, anything you want to add to that?
I mean, I guess the only thing I would say is that, I mean, he's exactly right. I mean, the I mean, the profit shifting that the companies are engaging in is that the kind of level that we're seeing really kind of started to soar in the mid-90s, in part because of a Clinton administration Treasury Department rule change that essentially opened the floodgates for this kind of profit shifting into subsidiaries offshore. But, you know, the same way that was done with a relatively kind of easy rule change, some of it could be made much more difficult with another relatively easy rule change. And there is a very interesting difference between the way this issue has been confronted in Europe for the last 4 or 5 years, not just Europe, but the world broadly outside the U.S. and within the U.S. And with the exception of that hearing on Apple back in 2013, it's gotten remarkably little high-profile attention from Congress. And, you know, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a kind of government-funded think tank that sets guidelines for international tax rules for companies, has been engaged in a project for the last 5 years to try to change some of this. And the U.S. has been a kind of quiet opponent of what they've been doing and has been somewhat an outlier, not supporting their work.
But what does that tell us? Is it kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're just going to let the system continue as is? We'll have hearings and we'll get all angry and finger point, but nothing will change?
Well, there isn't really that much finger pointing here in the U.S. I mean, I think one thing to remember is that these are I hate to use the word loopholes, but these are kind of weaknesses or in the kind of international tax rules that are disproportionately exploited by U.S. multinationals to some degree, because the world's biggest multinationals are U.S. multinationals. And so you have to remember the way this plays out is that these are essentially subsidies that other countries are perhaps unwittingly paying to help support U.S. companies abroad. And if you look at it kind of from that perspective, then you can sort of understand why U.S. lawmakers are reluctant to change that, because effectively, you know, if Google and Apple pay essentially single-digit tax rates overseas, you know, that puts them in a better position competitively with some of the other competitors overseas. So you can sort of see why U.S. regulators may be reluctant to do something about that. And also, you should understand that these companies are almost certainly avoiding taxes here in the U.S., but it's nothing like the magnitude of the tax avoidance they're engaged in overseas. I mean, you can look and see the financial reports of Google, Starbucks, Amazon, Apple in these countries overseas, where in some cases they are literally paying almost no corporate income taxes at all. And so it's a much more pronounced problem outside the U.S. for these multinationals than it is inside the U.S.
You mentioned Wilbur Ross. He's the U.S. Commerce Secretary. And just to encapsulate what has been revealed from these Paradise Papers, that he has a stake in a shipping company that got something like $68 million in revenue from an energy company co-owned by the son-in-law of Vladimir Putin. I don't know how much you can add to that, Jesse, in terms of what does that tell us? And the fact that he's Commerce Secretary, it seems to me, raises some red flags.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've basically sort of summed up what the main issue there, right? It's not just Putin's son-in-law, but it's also Gennady Timchenko, who is a long time, who's very close to Putin, who actually the State Department back in 2014 essentially said that Timchenko was holding a stake in his company Gunvor on behalf of Vladimir Putin. And so the notion that Wilbur Ross has this really quite a significant business relationship, ongoing business relationship, or his company does, with these guys is actually quite extraordinary. And remember, he's not just an investor in this company. He was the chairman of the company at one point. So, you know, obviously it's another potential tie between significant Russian political and business interests and a member of the Trump cabinet.
Well, let's talk a bit about Yuri Milner, a Russian billionaire and a major investor in Facebook and Twitter. Apparently lives in Silicon Valley now. What do we need, Jesse, to know about Yuri Milner?
So Yuri Milner, as you described, is a very successful venture capitalist, both here in the U.S. and abroad. He is from Russia. And beginning in 2009, he started to invest in the U.S. His first significant U.S. investment, it may have actually been his first U.S. investment period, was a $200 million investment in Facebook. This was years before the IPO. And by the time Facebook went public, Yuri Milner's various companies owned a little over 8% of the company. So he was quite a significant shareholder in Facebook. His company was also a significant shareholder in Twitter. They bought about a $380 million stake in Twitter in 2011, again, several years before Twitter went public. And what the documents show, both in the Paradise Papers and also there are many interesting disclosures in the Panama Papers, the leak from Mossack Fonseca from last year, what they basically show is are the significant financial links between Mr. Milner's investment firm, DST, and the Kremlin. Basically, his investment in Twitter, about half that cash, came from VTB, which is the second biggest bank in Russia. It's 61% owned by the Russian government and is used, everyone in Russia knows, is used with some frequency by the Kremlin for kind of politically strategic and sensitive operations. And when it comes to the Facebook deal, you know, one of Mr. Milner's biggest backers is an Uzbek-Russian oligarch named Alisher Usmanov. And what the documents show is that the investment vehicle, one of the investment vehicles DST used to do the Facebook deal had received hundreds of millions of dollars from Gazprom Invest Holdings, which is another kind of arm of the Russian state. And so in all, it shows the degree to which Milner's wealth was really built, at least in part, on a foundation of kind of state-controlled Russian entities. And entities, not just state-controlled, but entities that are really used for kind of strategic purposes of the Russian government.
Which raises a whole host of tantalizing questions about whether Milner knew who was backed by these Russian banks and ties to the Russian government, whether that in any way implicates him with the collusion charge and Facebook and Twitter and how it was used to disseminate all sorts of crazy looking information.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we need to be a little bit careful. I mean, there's no evidence that Mr. Milner personally had anything to do with any of that. I think what it shows, though, is that clearly the Russian government had an interest in these companies going back far longer than I think anyone realizes. And I think there's a belief that the kind of Russian intelligence started using social media in the 2016 election. That's a mistake. I mean, you know, we know about their use of social media as far back as at least 2011, when there were widespread protests on the streets of Moscow. And you can go back and find stories from 2011 that use the terms fake news and Twitter bots, where the Kremlin was apparently using things like that to try to interfere in the protests 6 years ago. And so, again, I think what these disclosures show is kind of further evidence that the Russian government seemed to have an interest in these companies going back as far back as 2009. Now, it's possible that it was simply a financial interest, that they were purely interested in figuring out a way to make money. And, you know, Alisher Usmanov, who is Mr. Milner's backer, is close to Dmitry Medvedev. And it's possible that this was just kind of another form of the Russian government helping an oligarch, a politically plugged-in oligarch, and there really is no other kind of oligarch in Russia, but helping an oligarch get rich and having the state get cut in on that. But there were possibly strategic motivations as well. We don't really know.
Let me see what Ken from Willingboro has to say. Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Ken. I think we lost him. He wanted to know how much holding. We just entirely lost him, so I'm not sure I entirely got his question there. But how much, I guess, holdings in the United States? I'm not sure I'm asking his question correctly, or you even understand what I'm asking you, because I'm not sure I do.
I'm sorry. What is the question?
You know what? I'm going to have to move on. Unfortunately, we lost him, and I can't in any way summarize what he was trying to ask you. I'm curious, though, for you, what it is like to look through these papers. Are they dense? Do you need to sort of figure out what the code words are to figure out what it is that you're looking at, or what this company, this law firm Appleby, was doing?
Yeah, they're pretty dense. I mean, you know, you can sort of go in with some different keywords or phrases that you're looking for. You know, it's sort of a challenge. I mean, the only real way to kind of get the useful information out of them is to really just kind of spend a lot of time with them. And, you know, we had a luckily one of the great things about the project is that you were collaborating with a lot of really good journalists who really had this, you know, kind of patience and time to go through some of these documents. I mean, the, you know, the Milner story would not have been possible without a really kind of diligent reporter at the BBC named Guy Grandjean, who really was the first one that found some of these things on Milner's company, and Spencer Woodman at ICIJ, and John Swain and Luke Harding at The Guardian. I mean, I think, you know, kind of all of us just spent an incredible amount of time with these documents. And same thing, you know, for the Apple story. I mean, Simon Bowers, you know, formerly at The Guardian, now at ICIJ, that Apple story would not have happened without his hard work, you know, really just kind of obsessively looking through these things and putting together connections.
Are there more reports to come from these papers?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's definitely, look, there's endless material in there. You know, we don't have anything, there's nothing kind of on tap for the next few days. But yeah, I mean, there's clearly going to be more to come out of those documents.
And you think, I'm thinking about the Panama Papers. We did a show about that when the Panama Papers came out last year. Now we're talking about the Paradise Papers in sort of a variation of what I asked you earlier. But do you think this will make a difference, especially since Congress is trying to figure out, or Republicans in Congress are trying to figure out some kind of changes to our tax code. Do you think this will make a difference?
I don't know. I certainly hope so. I mean, hopefully, you know, things like what we wrote about Apple will focus some attention on some of the problems with that system. But I don't know. Right. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, you know, I've been writing about those sorts of issues for more than 10 years. Right. And, you know, there really is there just really isn't in Washington, you know, you sort of look at, you know, whether it's the environment and you have, you know, Greenpeace, or you look at choice issues and you have Planned Parenthood. There really is no there's sort of no Greenpeace for tax justice. The lobbying on tax issues, on these international tax issues, comes from big law firms and big accounting firms, and the representatives of the tax departments of big multinationals. There really isn't a significant public interest lobby on these sorts of issues, and I think until that happens, it's sort of hard to imagine how the dynamic on policy and legislation changes significantly.
Is that because it's so complicated, or because it largely is the purview of very wealthy people and wealthy corporations?
I don't know. I think probably part of it is complication. I mean, I will say that in overseas, more than here, I think there really has become more of a movement around some of these issues. In other words, I think there are sort of young activists who, you know, previously might have gotten involved in, say, environmental issues, who have now become drawn to tax justice issues. Mm. But for whatever reason, that hasn't quite translated here in the United States.
So it's legal. I mean, is it unethical? I don't even know how to ask or what the answer to that question is.
Well, you know, I think that there's a how can I put this? I think that there is sort of a mistaken belief that what some of the multinationals do is, well, maybe that's not desirable, but it's legal. And if we want to change this, then you need to change the law. And there is obviously tremendous merit to that. Obviously, the existing law permits companies to drive a kind of Mack truck through the regulations. That said, it's not obvious that a lot of these structures are perfectly legal, in fact. I mean, they're constantly being challenged by the IRS. They're constantly being challenged by tax authorities across the world. And tax experts who are have knowledge of them, who are no longer in the position of actually working on them, where their, you know, opinions tend to get dictated by who's paying their bills, you know, will say that the world of transfer pricing and profit shifting by multinationals really is kind of a fictional world, and a lot of these transactions make no sense.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Jesse Drucker, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Reporter for the New York Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.